All right, we're in the second month of a three-month-ish study of the Sermon on the Mount. We'll see how that goes. But as you can see on the cover, if you have the material, what we're doing is taking this short sermon. We noticed that it really only took Jesus maybe 15 minutes to preach it. But we're taking this short sermon and we're trying to remember it in eight unique sections. So far in our class, we started with the section on the Beatitudes, Matthew chapter 5, verses 1 through 12. That's how Jesus begins the sermon. We titled that, Be Happy. The word for blessed there is fortunate, blessed, happy. There's a real sense of optimism there. And so that's how Jesus began, with saying that my people have a tremendous attitude. My people have a positive outlook towards what's going on around them, no matter what's going on around them, because of the blessings that my Father provides. So section one, we studied the first couple of weeks, be happy. Then we studied the short section, Matthew chapter 5, verses 13 through 16. We titled that, Be Influential. All right, so you have a good attitude, you're seeing the bright side of discipleship, now let's get out there and make a difference. And we are really familiar with the two illustrations Jesus used there. You've studied it many, many times. Be salt, be light. Make a difference, preserve integrity, make things better, and be a light in a dark place. Draw people to the light that is Jesus. And that's what we finished up last week or 2 weeks ago before the gospel meeting, was the section on be influential. So that brings us to Matthew chapter 5 and our first really long section. We're taking verse 17 of Matthew 5 all the way through to the end of the chapter, and we're calling this Be Righteous. In order to be a disciple of Jesus, a positive outlook is great. Being influential is important. But what makes all that possible is living the right kind of righteous life. And so he's going to delve into that here, beginning in verse 17. Now, as you look at verse 17, let me read 17 through 20. It seems like a bit of a departure from what he's been doing in this sermon so far. Verse 17 says, Do not think that I came to abolish the law or the prophets. I did not come to abolish, but to fulfill. For truly I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not the smallest letter or stroke shall pass from the law until all is accomplished. Whoever, verse 19, then, annuls one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same, shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever keeps and teaches them, he shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I say to you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. Now let me just ask you a bit of an open-ended question. Starts this sermon. These disciples are gathered all around him. And he says, Blessed are you. Blessed and fortunate are all of you. Go out and be salt and be light and make a difference. And then in verse 17, he says, Do not think that I came to abolish the law or the prophets. I did not come to abolish, but to fulfill. Why did he throw that in right there? It was such a great, optimistic, good attitude, make a difference sermon. And then in verse 17, he turns his attention abruptly to the law. Why do you think he did that? Any guesses? Let's say you were there. You are one of the disciples. What do you know well? You know the law really well. You have been taught the law of Moses since the moment you could first process thought. Your entire history and all of the history you have ever known or studied has been about the meticulous following of the law. Here comes this guy, Jesus. He sits down on the side of the mountain. He's worked some miracles. He's shown some things about himself. And he's just preaching all these really interesting things you've never heard before. Not in this way. No one had ever heard anything quite like the Beatitudes. That was the first time in the history of the world that it had been said like that. And then light and salt. This isn't the 647 Law of Moses tenets. This is preaching. So if I'm sitting there listening, I'm really enjoying his introduction, but in the back of my mind, what am I thinking about? What about the law? What does this mean with respect to the law? Is this guy a usurper of the law? Is this man trying to get us to forget it? I'd be thinking that, and so would you. It's all you know how to think about. And so it's almost like Matthew 5 verses 1 through 16 is sort of what we would call in preacher talk, his power open. He didn't say, welcome, thank you for being here, hope your drive wasn't too long. No, he just started preaching. Really good stuff. Blessed, light, salt. But now he's got to kind of turn to the body of his lesson a little bit, and that means addressing their heritage. So here's what he says about their heritage. Do not think, and I would suggest to you that he's saying, I know what you're thinking. Do not think that I came to abolish the law or the prophets. I did not come to abolish, but to fulfill. Now notice the comment that is on your material. Jesus did not come to destroy the law, but to fulfill it. That's what he said. This is what we call the not but construction. You guys familiar with the not but construction? It's only on every single page of your entire Bible. That's the only place you'll find it, every page of your Bible. It's a really powerful figure of speech that the Bible writers use, which means I'm not focusing on the second thing so much as I'm focusing on, or the first thing so much as I'm focusing on the second thing. It's not that first thing that's really the power statement. It's the greater emphasis of the second. An example we always talk about is when Jesus said, do not work for the food which perishes, but for the food of eternal life. If the emphasis was on the first thing, we ought to quit our jobs because I'm working for the food which perishes, aren't you? I'm working. We go to Walmart. It's always $7,000. You've been there. He's saying, but more important than that is working for your eternal life. Well, this is much like that. Verse 17, do not think that I came to abolish the law or the prophets. He did do that. He did that. He destroyed it. He took it out. But that's not really what this was about. The greater thing is I am merely fulfilling exactly what the law of Moses had said. Is this important when you're sitting on the side of a mountain talking to a bunch of Jews about the kingdom? That they know that they're not going to be put to death just for listening to you? That you're not trying to circumvent and upturn everything they've ever known? It was really important for him to say, I did not come to abolish but to fulfill. Now, what does he mean when he says, but to fulfill? Okay. All right. Okay. They had been taught to look for this. It's much like that surprising Samaritan woman that's not supposed to know anything. And she said, I know the Messiah is coming. Really? How'd you know that? We've been taught that our whole lives. Now, what it's ultimately teaching here, of course, is that the old law actually prophesied of its own demise. It in itself predicted that its time was short. The perfect example of that might be Hebrews chapter 8. Take a look there for just a moment. You remember this section in Hebrews 8, verses 6 through 13, that is effectively describing what Jesus is saying. The first Hebrews 8, 13 would become obsolete. You can say destroyed, abolished, taken out of the way, obsolete. That's exactly what happened. It was made obsolete so that the new could come. But in order to describe it, in verse 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12, what does the Hebrew writer do? 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12. It's all Old Testament quotations. He brings the entire argument that the old law was there for a while, but something new was coming, something that would be written on their hearts, something that would be different. He uses the Old Testament to make all those points. So that's sort of a substance of what Jesus is saying. He's saying, if you'll go back and study the law, you'll see that it brought you here. And I am the fulfillment of that. So back in Matthew 5:17, I just want you to see that this isn't some strange, out of sort of left field observation. He needs to talk about what they're thinking, the law. So here's what else he has to say about it. Look at verse 18. For truly I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not the smallest letter or stroke shall pass away from the law until all is accomplished. What's he saying there? They love the law. They live for it. All right. Nothing is going to happen against the law's will. It will carry all of its power and potency and importance in your life just like it always has. Heaven and earth can't change that until it's time.
all is accomplished. The point I put here on your sheet is Jesus clearly teaches the Jews that the old law would remain into effect until all is accomplished, which we know to be the introduction of the church by Jesus' death, resurrection, and ascension to the throne. In Ephesians chapter 1, you're probably really familiar with that. In Ephesians chapter 1, verses 19 through 23, Jesus ascended and the Father placed him at the right hand of God, and he gave him all power and rule and authority and dominion over every name that is named, and he gave him the church. That's a change. That wasn't there before. That's something that God established. The end of the law came when Jesus sat upon his throne in the Christian dispensation. So he's giving respect to the law, which again is really important when you look at his audience. But he's telling them, he's sort of adding this language like, until all is accomplished. Then in verse 19 he says, more of what they would like to hear. Whoever then annuls one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever keeps and teaches them, he shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. Now I want you to think about why he said that. You believe Jesus is the Son of God. The Son of God. He is sitting on the side of a mountain and you are sitting at his feet. He is preaching to you that the kingdom is for humble people. It's for sincere people. It's for people who love me, who are the right example. That's what the kingdom is about. Go away. What are you tempted to do? I would be. Did I mention there are like 647 laws? Lots of animals, lots of blood, lots of trips to Jerusalem, lots and lots of curses, effectively, in terms of our inability to follow it. Boy, I'd really want to leave there and go, well, there you go. It's the best sermon ever. We don't have to do any of the things that we used to have to do, and everything has changed. Now, there was coming a transition, but Jesus' sermon was not that transition. So he's coming back and saying, look, whoever annuls any of these commandments and teaches others to do them shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. And I think that's a figure of speech for you ain't getting in. Sometimes the least and most just means in or out, plus or minus, one or zero. If you can't keep that law and you're looking for a way out of law, you're not going to want to follow me. Because Jesus had law as well. And so he's saying you have to keep that. And then he comes back and says, whoever keeps and teaches them, he shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. Now, why would he say that? If you keep the law of Moses, how would that make you great in the kingdom of heaven? What do you think?
Because law, whether it's the old one or the new one, at this point it's the old.
Yeah. If you're looking for a way out of law, you're never going to be a Christian. If you live under the law of Moses and you're doing your best because it's, and I like the way Gary said it, it's just God's law. This is God's will for me. Then when Christ comes and translates that from one dispensation to another, law keepers will line up to do what God wants them to do. I think it's more of a looking forward, a forecasting to who would be in the kingdom. Not those who are trying to get out of this, but those who are in. And then he raises the stakes. He's pretty good at this. Verse 20. For I say to you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. Now, I would perceive that as just a regular old guy as a really scary statement. Because as just a regular old Jew in Jerusalem or wherever they are, Galilee or wherever they are on the way, when you mention Pharisees and scribes, who are you talking about? Law-wise, respect-wise, righteousness-wise. It'd be like saying, and I hesitate to say this since I'm one of these, but it'd be like saying, unless you are more righteous than your preacher. Now, that's a great example. I'll tell you why in a minute. Unless you are more righteous than your preacher, you can't get to heaven. Now, your immediate response is what? Oh, no. My preacher's like, awesome. But you know what a preacher is? Just a guy who preaches. Just a guy who preaches. I may be righteous, I may not be righteous. I pray I am, I'm trying, I need your help. But I'm just saying by title, doesn't mean a whole lot.
And this is where this sermon just gets really incredible. He's really baited them for this. He's addressed the law. He's addressed that he came to fulfill it, that it'll be there till he gets ready, and that you need to keep it. And then he sort of throws in this idea, you need to be more righteous. Now, that would be an extremely confusing statement for me. This is what you would call like the bait and switch, or the catch of a sermon. How would I be more righteous than they? And what he's really going to show here is their righteousness is not as great as you think it is. I need people who are righteous from the heart, not just outwardly. How often in Jesus' ministry did he ridicule and condemn the scribes and the Pharisees? You remember some of the things he condemned them for? What were some of the things? They preached with their hands a lot. They prayed loudly. They put on the show, you know. But they were like whitewashed tombs, right? Still dead man's bones on the inside. Now, we don't want to be that way. And I pray that your preacher's not that way. But the point is, outside stuff's not the whole story. It's the inside stuff. It's who you are. It's how you think. It's the way you interact with other people. That's where your righteousness is from. Now, that will affect the way you pray. It will affect the way you look. It will affect the way you go about interacting with others. So here's what he does. This body of the sermon has 6 points to it. He's going to 6 times say, you learned this from the law, but this is what I've come to tell you. And this is where he really shakes up their world a little bit. So what I've asked you to do here, about midway through the lesson, we're on lesson 3, be righteous. In the remainder of the section, verses 21 through 48, Jesus cites 6 examples to challenge the disciples to consider what they have been told, either what they've been told in the old law or what they've been told by the Pharisees, and compare that to the righteousness he would require in the church. Below is a list of the 6 topics. Use the text provided to fill in the details of what they had heard versus what Jesus was now saying and to us all, and then sort of put down what it means for us all. What's the point? So to help you with that, and I've tried to do this throughout the material, I just did one of them for you. So turn to verses 33 through 37. Basically, I kind of picked the simplest, what I perceive to be the simplest ones, so that you could delve into the deeper ones maybe. But I think it's just a good way of illustrating this. Verse 33 through 37, and then we'll go back and let everyone participate. Again, you have heard the ancients were told, you shall not make false vows, but shall fulfill your vows to the Lord. So on your material, that's what I put as my first answer. You have heard, you shall not make false vows, but shall fulfill your vows to the Lord. I put down passages for this. Your marginal note probably would give you most of these. Leviticus 19, Numbers 30, and then Moses addressed it again in Deuteronomy 23. This is true of the law. Every good scribe and Pharisee knew it. Every good Jew could quote it. And they would not take some oath or vow and break it because the penalty was great. But I say to you, make no oath at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by the earth, for it is the footstool of his feet, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Nor shall you make an oath by your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black. But let your statement be yes, yes, or no, no. Anything beyond this is evil. So under the section, but I say to you, I put, quote, make no oath at all, but let your statement be yes or no. Anything beyond this is of evil. The oath then would be about show, not substance, hence it is of evil. If you make an oath and it's all about the oath and not about actually fulfilling it, then it's just for show. And show was their big problem. Now, I'm not really convinced here, and I'm interested in what you think. I don't think he's telling them to break the law. He's just saying there's something more important than the oath itself. You know, people who have to swear on this and promise on that and take an oath on this and put their house on the line. You know, I swear with my house that I'm going to do this. Jesus said, that's just blubber. It's just words. My people, just do it. My people say it and they do it. If the answer is yes, you can count on them to the best of their ability. If the answer is no, they have a reason for saying no. They don't have to promise you it's no, or swear it's no, or put their wife up for collateral it's no, or swear on some book, it's just no.
their people, his people, stand for such a thing. And that's the point. God's people are truthful. We need not promise or swear or put a hand on a Bible. And again, I'm not convinced here that he's saying you can't do that. If you go to a court of law and they say, place your hand here on the Bible and repeat after me, and you say, oh, I can take no oath at all, I'm not convinced that's his point here. His point is sort of like that not but construction, much more important than holding your hand up and wearing a nice suit and reciting something. It's just being a person of integrity. All that is superfluous. It's unnecessary. The passage that I wanted to use, and I really encourage you to do this on the other ones, is to just add some other New Testament passage that adds a little bit of extra substance to that. And so I chose James chapter 5 and verse 12. James 5 and 12, but above all, my brethren, do not swear either by heaven or by earth or with any oath, but, there's your not but construction, but your yes is to be yes, your no, no, so that you may not fall under judgment. It's basically a verbatim restatement that James is making over what Jesus said. God's people tell the truth. And that's the point here. All right, any comments or questions about the idea of oath keeping? All right. Yes, sir. Well, this one says in verse 33, again, you have heard that the ancients were told or said to the ancients. And then we have a direct quote, verse 33. This comes directly from, I think it's the Leviticus passage. You've learned this. This is your law, that you shall not make false vows, but shall fulfill your vow to the Lord. You make a vow, you keep it. So they were familiar with that. This is true language. But in my kingdom, vows aren't even necessary. I think that's the only point he's making here. The vows aren't even necessary.
We would go into the temple and they would read.
Yeah.
Jesus even read some law and they commented on what it was going to be. So they're familiar with sitting down and hearing it read to them.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, these are quotes that would come, I would think, readily to mind for them immediately. Yes, sir?
The law was better not to vow than to make a vow and not pay.
Yeah. The penalties were great. You could lose your life over a vow. And of course, he's not really taking it down a notch. He's kind of bringing it up a notch, right? Because under the law, you know, if I told you something and didn't do it, okay, you can't really catch me in that. You can't prove it. But if you've got me like making some vow or I recited something or signed something, now you got me. Jesus is kind of kicking that up and saying, you know what? Always tell the truth. Does it have to be documented? You don't have to have witnesses. Just tell the truth. And when you say no, stand by it. And so it's more of a heart and daily living law, the Christian law, than what they would have been familiar with. All right, comments or questions about oaths? All right, it's your turn. Let's go back to verses 21 through 26. We're in Matthew 5. He doesn't begin with oaths. That's just our example. He begins with anger. So I'm going to read verses 21 through 26 and then let everyone participate in filling in these blanks. Here's his first example. You have heard that the ancients were told, you shall not commit murder, and whoever commits murder shall be liable to the court. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother shall be guilty before the court. And whoever says to his brother, you good for nothing, shall be guilty before the Supreme Court. And whoever says you fool shall be guilty enough. Reading from the New American Standard, it adds, enough to go into the fiery hell. Therefore, if you are presenting your offering at the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your offering there before the altar and go. First be reconciled to your brother, then come and present your offering. Notice he's still talking about offerings. Make friends quickly with your opponent at law while you are with him on the way, so that your opponent may not hand you over to the judge and the judge to the officer, and you will be thrown into prison. Truly, I say to you, you will not come out of there until you have paid up the last cent. You know, it's interesting. Sometimes we think that the old law was really hard and the new law is sort of less rigid. I don't know. The old law had its life and death moments. The new law just really wants control of everything you do. It wants to influence every relationship that you have, and that's what he's doing with this point. So let's start with this, anger. What had they heard? do not murder. Everybody knew that it was against the law and death penalty if you murder. There are passages for this. Does anybody cite any passages for it? Maybe like the Ten Commandments. Exodus 20, right? That was where it first came out. Exodus 20, thou shall not murder, kill. Deuteronomy 5, remember, if you're in Deuteronomy, you're hearing the sermon again. After the 40 years of wandering in the wilderness, he comes back in Deuteronomy 5 and says it again, do not murder. They were really clear on that. Pharisees would not murder. You would never find a scribe killing someone physically, literally. But those Pharisees and scribes are accused over and over of robbing widows' houses and discrediting the impoverished and treating a lot of people with a lot of contempt. They didn't kill anyone. You've heard. And he's not negating that. Look, really don't kill people. Do not murder. And that becomes a tenet of the law of Christ as well. But I say to you, what does he say to them instead? Do not be angry with your brother without cause. Is that how you said it? Okay. What else? There is a judgment danger. Now, here's the thing. Law of Moses, if you killed someone, you knew you were in judgment danger. If someone found out about that, you would lose your life. Judgment was imminent. Under his law, as God reads hearts, even your attitude towards another person can have equal ramifications because everything is what we call sin if it violates the law of God, whether it's hatred or murder, and God is looking at those things. What do you guys make of this sort of climbing sense in verse 22? Everyone who is angry, guilty before the court. Whoever says, and this is my version, if you have, or New American, if you have another version, chime in. You good for nothing, guilty before the Supreme Court. Whoever says you fool shall be guilty enough to go into the fiery hell. Was that true under the law of Moses? I'm bringing Adam in. I'm saying, he called me dumb in front of my kids. And they open up the book and say, here's what we'll do to Adam. I don't think that's what was happening. I think he's just using their common language to say, in my kingdom, in the Supreme Court system in which I will rule, I'm going to be looking at things like anger, name calling, and just derogatory speech towards other people. I'm going to be looking at that stuff. Yes, sir?
It seems to me that the law of Moses didn't go far enough. Okay. Adding some more to it.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah, I would say that here. There'll be some of these where it seems like he's saying we need to get away from that direction and go this direction. But this seems to be one where he's just adding depth to it. He's adding an everyday, all the time heart element to it, isn't he? So what's the point? You can answer two or three. Yeah, here first. Seeds out from the mind, right? Yes. And the equating there is not that they are equal in every sense, but in one sense they are. They're a violation of love. There's really only two laws. You guys know that, right? There's really only five words. You could take the whole Bible and who we're supposed to be, and you could write five words on the page. Love God, love your neighbor. This is all a violation of love your neighbor. And that's why you can't categorize what's more punishable over the other. Now, the difference is, of course, I've gotten angry at people a lot more often than I've murdered people. I'm at like 2,000 to 0 ratio right now. I need mercy. I need grace. I need God to forgive. We need all the things that Jesus is going to bring. But this section is about us doing the best we can to be righteous. So what we're going to see in a minute is, if you see that this has happened to you, that there is somebody who has something against you, you've done something, you've caused this, that becomes the most important thing in your life right now. What did Jesus say that makes a statement I just made true? You've got somebody who has something against you, something's not right, and you caused this. That becomes the most important thing in your life right now. What did he say in his words, in his better words? It's the altar. It's the place where you worship God. It's maybe your sin offering. If you're a Jew, it may be your animal offering for your sin. What's more important than offering my animal sacrifice and having my sins forgiven? This. Because you can't be forgiven of something that's outstanding as soon as you turn around and walk away from the altar. You still have an issue with your brother. So there's really this sense of how this is going to live for us. We're not going to be perfect at this all the time, but boy, we should be on a mission of mending relationships whenever possible. I think about passages like, be at peace, if at all possible, be at peace with all men whenever we can. Yes, sir.
Sun go down on the wrath. So you, when you're angry, you're not to let it fester. You're supposed to meditate on what you have, what has happened. And you're supposed to reconcile.
Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am.
One thing that really occurs to me is the scribes and Pharisees throughout New Testament times were caught up in the actions. They kept, you know, I can't remember exactly the scripture, and I'm trying to find it, but, you know, when you look at how they kept the old law and everything, they're caught up in the actions of, you know, well, we don't do this on the Sabbath because that was the law, and, you know, Jesus was healing, you know, those with the Sabbath and stuff. And this point is goes back to what Kelly was saying, it goes to the heart. They weren't getting the heart apart. They were getting, we're doing all of the actions, and, you know, therefore we are right because we are doing these actions. He's taking it a step farther into the heart.
Very well said. Yes, sir?
Jesus is preparing us for the new law, or preparing the disciples, preparing the people, his audience, for the new law. And under the old law, it's a law of action. But under Jesus' law, it's a law of the heart. And it's not about your actions. It's about how you feel, what you say, what you think about other people, more than it is about your actions.
Okay. Here's what's really great about this. I kind of feel like we get a free pass on this as long as we're right. You said something earlier, we're talking about, you know, it's without cause. You know, but what if I'm right and you're wrong? And I'm angry with you, and I should be angry with you. Because you're a mess, and I'm right, and you're wrong, and I just know it, and I know that when we get to God one day, that it's just going to work out, and I was going to be justified for my anger my entire life, because you've been wrong your whole life. I think the passage that really stands out to me most out of this whole section is verse 25. Make friends quickly with your opponent at law while you're on with him on the way. Now, on the way, I'm like this. I'm confident. You're wrong. I'm right. I'm mad at you, and I should be, and when we get to the judge and he shows you everything that I know that he knows that you know, I'm going to win this thing. And then they show up in court, and it doesn't go my way. There are facts revealed that I thought were going to stay hidden. There were angles that I didn't know, and all of a sudden all that anger I thought was so justifiable wasn't justified at all, and it went the other way. It reminds me, I wrote down a little marginal note right here of Proverbs 25. Listen to this. Proverbs 25, verse 8. Do not go out hastily to argue your case. Otherwise, what you will do in the end, what will you do in the end when your neighbor humiliates you? Argue your case with your neighbor and do not reveal the secret of another, or he who hears it will reproach you and the evil report about you will not pass away. You thought you had it, but you didn't. So much anger that Jesus says, I don't want it there. I don't want you to carry that around with you. I don't want you feeling that way about others. I don't want you talking that way about others. I don't want any of that in my people at all. But you don't understand. I'm right about this. Well, I would argue that even if you are right, that's not the way to handle it. A lot of people are going to be really surprised one day when they realize they weren't really even right at all. Their anger blinded them from what they should have seen the whole time. Josh?
7, he's talking about taking a brother to court in front of unbelievers, but it says, now therefore it is already another failure for you that you go to law against one another. Why do you not rather accept wrong? Why do you not rather let yourselves be cheated rather than going through that process?
That's a great point, and we're going to see that again when we get to turn the other cheek, giving over your coat, and all of that. Rather that you got me twice than that I once harbor something inside of me that Jesus doesn't want there. Rather you take everything from me than I hold on to something that doesn't belong. Anger issues have destroyed a lot of relationships, a lot of families, a lot of churches, a lot of communities. And it didn't really matter who was right in the end because you still have a mess on your hands. City's still on fire no matter who started it. And I think there's just this sense in which Jesus is saying we have to get past all this superficial stuff and we have to get down to real relationships every day and how you want to be. There was plenty of hands over here. Yes, here and then back.
If we hold that anger inside of us and we don't forgive the other brother, then how are we supposed to, if he's not a Christian, how are we supposed to approach that person with any chance of helping to get them to heaven? We're angry with them all the time, but if we take that blame and that person sees that we take that blame and we're okay, we just let it go, then that influences him as to our character, and it can help you first of all.
Yeah, close the door. That's a good point. Yes.
The example that Paul gave us with the Corinthians and sacrificed meat, it's not exactly the same, but there was a lot of friction there. They were offended by eating the meat that had been sacrificed. And Paul said, it was Paul, you have to let that go. If it offends someone, then you need to be conscious of that and be aware of that and squelch all that anger and hostility.
Go out of your way. And I just think, and then we'll go over to Jonathan.
If I was preaching this in verse 23, I think I would have worded it differently. I think I would have said, if you are presenting your offering at the altar and you remember that you have something against a brother, you're angry with a brother. You're angry. Go to him, tell him why you're angry, and try to work that out. But that's not what it says. What does it say? He's got something against you. This relationship might be his anger. He's got something against you. We don't like dealing with things when people have something against us. I'd rather go deal with a situation where I have something against somebody else, because then I can go like this. But when somebody's against me, I mean, it's just such a humbling approach to say that, look, I'm not even angry with this guy, but I know this guy's angry with me, and I'm going to go work that out. I mean, that's going above and beyond. When you're trying to help the person who has something against you get over it, that's love. That's the kingdom. And sometimes we have trouble just getting past me being angry, much less am I willing to step out and try to help you stop being angry with me. But anyway, I think that Jesus sometimes goes to that really far stretch of, you know, incredible commitment to kind of wake us up sometimes. Jonathan?
The ones that are saying, you're a dummy, you're the fool, you know, I'm so much better, I'm on such a higher level than you, and that makes me angry when people do these things that are just so below me, and, you know, maybe it made me look foolish, and that's where the heart comes in, because it's not about our haughty attitude about how we're so much better because we're Christians, and I'm so much better than you because I'm a Christian and I do what's right. And you go over to Romans 12 and verse 14, bless those who persecute you and bless and do not curse them. Rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. Live in harmony with one another. Do not be haughty, but associate with the lowly. Never be wise in your own sight. Repay no one evil for evil, but give thought to do what is honorable in the sight of all. And it goes on to say, live peaceably with all. Don't avenge yourself. We'll get that into that later. But it goes back to get rid of our haughty attitude. We're not better than you. We're Christians.
Way to wrap it up. That really ties well back to the Pharisees. Just about like you do, please. Next Wednesday night, we will continue in lesson 3. Don't do all 4.